Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. It's 27th day of March, 2024, right here on Revolution Radio. Delighted to be joined by my regular Friday co-host, John Carman, former Secret Service. I especially wanted John to join today because my featured guest joining at the bottom of the hour is Jerry Corsi, who's a rather well-known author, and in this instance, co-author with David W. Mantic, MD, PhD, the leading expert on the medical evidence in the assassination of JFK, on their new book, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy, The Final Analysis, which is of the medical evidence. It's really an important contribution. It's taken off like a rocket, sold some 4,000 copies the first week between the 8th of March and the Ides of March on the 15th, 4,000 copies. Let me just contrast. The average academic book, scholarly book, might sell 750 in its lifetime. When I put out Nobody Died at Sandy Hook on the 22nd of October 2015, it had sold nearly 500 copies in less than a month when it was banned by Amazon on the 19th of November. I'm convinced, acting as an agent of the state in violation of the First Amendment because it had too much truth. Well, what that means is the Mantic Corsi book is going to be a bestseller without any doubt, and I believe that that number of sales, which is rather staggering, indicates the thirst for truth by the American people. More to come when Jerry joins us at the bottom of the hour. Meanwhile, I must begin with this staggering event in Baltimore. The bridge collapse, clearly deliberate, no accident. We have the befuddled Biden coming out and saying, no, it's only an accident, nothing nefarious here. It's going to turn out to be an extortion plot by Ukraine that instead of, unless we keep sending them endless quantities of cash, they're going to continue to attack the United States. And sad to say, we have the most incompetent, the most corrupt administration in history to deal with this. And indeed, on our southern border, believe it or not, the Mexican president is also extorting the United States, saying that unless we give him bundles of cash, the migrant flow is going to continue. Now, I've surveyed quite a few of the reports about the bridge crash, and what I have here is the best of the lot so far. I want to share it, and then we'll discuss it in detail.
The bridge collapse in Baltimore is a black swan event. Now, it's much bigger than we know, so let's unpack this. And I have to say, I've done everything over the past 24 hours since this collapse happened in the early morning hours to say nothing to see here, total accident, mechanical problem, of course. It looks like a mechanical failure, a power outage, nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. Then General Mike Flynn has to go and call this a black swan event and says, look more deeply into this. So we have. And there's more than meets the eye. So what is a black swan event? Well, black swan event is, you know, you're just chugging along, looking at normal, you know, white swans that you normally see. Then suddenly everything seems predictable and normal. And then bam, giant black swan comes out of nowhere. Something totally unexpected blindsides you. It usually happens economically, right? We see that obviously with what happened in the 2008 collapse. That's exactly what a black swan event looks like. That's the essence of the swan event. Unexpected, impactful, often leaving us scrambling to make sense of what in the world just happened. So here's Mike Flynn's post on X this afternoon. This is a black swan event, he says. Black swans normally come out of the world of the finance, not military. The standard operating procedures for all U.S. ports, harbors, and bays that transit commerce and military activities are supposed to maintain an incredible level of discipline, rigor, and awareness for these very type of events not to occur ever. Yet here we are. There are harbor masters for every single one of these transit points in America that are in charge of assuring the safety of navigation. Start there, he says. So start there. Talk to the harbor masters. Don't necessarily look at the boat itself. That's maybe a red herring. Look at the harbor masters. Look at the infrastructure. Look at the electrical infrastructure. Look at the computers. Was it hacked? So look at that information, not just the boat itself, perhaps. So what do we know? Well, for one thing, we know the captain of the ship or the ship's master is Ukrainian. That's interesting. So here you can find that out easily by going to BalticShipping.com. You can punch in the information as we did here at Redacted. Go to the Dolly. The name of the ship is the Dolly. There you can see where it's currently sitting. It's now sitting there covered by a bridge right in Baltimore in the Chesapeake Harbor in Baltimore. And there is the ship's master. He is Ukrainian. Interesting. And UK Telegram channels today posting congratulations to great work. And to expect more surprises in Europe, too, unless we approve more aid to Ukraine. Maybe it's a total coincidence here, these Ukrainian Telegram posts. This is a beautiful work, though, all over the world without hesitation. If you don't accept the aid package, then get it. Look forward to our surprises throughout Europe. We will teach you to defend democracy and help those who need it.
How to stay alive in a catastrophic car accident like this, even after falling into water reservoir, a fatal construction flaw in all recent automobiles.
Huh.
So maybe.
I haven't seen anything like that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, maybe this is just some like Telegram opportunists, you know, on different Telegram channels just trying to play into this, right? Try to scare us. Or maybe there's something more to it. Who knows? But those posts exist on Ukrainian Telegram channels.
It's like the Goodfellas. You got this? F you, pay me. You do this? F you, pay me. Like,
yeah.
You know, we're that kind of attitude.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there would have been a Chesapeake Bay pilot on board also. So anytime you're going in and out of one of these harbors, you're going in, you know, even if you're going into Norway and you're going into Stavanger, like the port of Stavanger in Norway, you have to wait outside of the channel. You have to wait until the Stavanger pilot comes on board. Just the same you have to do here in the Chesapeake Bay. Chesapeake Bay pilot needs to assist the master and is on board. They know everything about this harbor. They know every detail of it, and they are going to guide you out. You're from Singapore. A Chesapeake Bay pilot will be on board and guiding the ship out. And that's what was happening. The ship was being guided out of port on its way out to sea and transporting large amounts of cargo. So it was leaving. It was almost about to leave. And here's the video of the incident. So here's, we're going to watch this incident kind of in real time with some highlights on how this all breaks down here. So at about the first reel, we sped it up a little bit here. You can see at about the 12-second mark. So this is going to go on for about 30 seconds. Okay, there's power loss number one at about 12 seconds. Okay, then at about 22 seconds, it recovers power. So it comes back on here. And then you see black smoke coming out of the engine, out of the, whatchamacallit, the funnel. And then immediate evasive maneuver, the stack, yeah. Then immediate evasive maneuvers take place. Helicopter, you know, images show that, in fact, one of the anchors was dropped on the port side. And there you have the smash and collapse of the bridge. Now, we also know, according to the mayor, that as a result of that, when they called in a Mayday call a few seconds before impact, they were able to divert traffic on the bridge, thankfully. And workers were able to stop and halt traffic coming across the bridge, which is why more people were not trapped on the bridge. There weren't more cars on the bridge at that time. So at least they had enough to say, Mayday, Mayday, where we've lost control. We don't have control of the ship. Get people off the bridge. And they were able to prevent at least a lot more people from being killed or missing as a result of this. So, but this is interesting. So journalist Michael Yon tweeted this afternoon, and this is a more detailed analysis of the ship leaving. Okay, so it's coming off the dock there and heading out into the open ocean. And you can see here, though, how it changes course right before it loses power, which is interesting. So now this is where things, to me, get really interesting. Why 2 minutes before, keep playing it if you would, or did it stop? Yeah. So, all right. Now, right here, you're going to see it change course before losing power and colliding. So why did it change course aiming directly into the pylon? It's a curious question, right? So why did it change course at that point? We don't know. Why did it change course? Now, if you lose power and you have to use some sort of a backup steering system, in some cases, you might be steering in the opposite direction of what you're used to. It's a reverse steering system. Now, I don't know if this ship was set up that way or not. This will be part of the investigation, I'm sure. So, and sometimes with backup power, that is the case with a steering column.
And also, isn't it kind of curious, like, those pylons have to be, like, they had to think about a boat running into those when they built that bridge, right? So one pylon going out collapses that much of the bridge? That seems like, that doesn't seem right. You know what I mean? Like, a boat could take out a pylon, like a whole bottom of the bridge. That doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, U.S. bridge infrastructure is built like 200 years ago. I don't know when the Francis Scott Key Bridge I don't know when this bridge was built, actually, to be honest with you. I mean, I've driven over it since, I think, childhood. My father's from Baltimore. I used to go down to the Chesapeake Bay and go crabbing. So me going down to like St. Michael's, going down to Chesapeake Harbor, one of my favorite foods in the world is Maryland Blue steamed crabs. It is my favorite food in the world. And so special times with my father.
Oh, John, I'm going to. Sure. Hang on. Let me pause it.
I don't know when this bridge was built, but I can tell you I remember driving over it for many, many years of my life. And also it's a single.
I doubt when it was built, though. It was built for 20,000 tons of ship.
Sure. That hit it. Right. Yeah. So and maybe someone can let us in know. 1977. Okay. So I was born 1976. Yeah. So it's been around as long as I've been alive. So interesting. Absorb one of these massive ships, doubtful. I don't know that anything could stop that. You know, can you build something that would prevent this? I don't know. I mean, think about this ship hitting any bridge in America would wipe it out. If this thing hits the Golden Gate Bridge, it would probably collapse the Golden Gate Bridge, right? You would think the massive size of this thing disrupting one pylon and all of it comes down like a house of cards. I don't know. Anyway, so now I want to play this for you. So that was, you saw the track coming out. You saw
John,
changing direction in about two minutes.
It's just the video part.
But now I want to show you this.
Yeah, but it shows it speeding up and the whole thing. I mean, this is really good. Really good.
I'll share it here. Yeah, I just want to make a comment about
how much it had to divert itself. Look at
it.
Watch this.
Hang on.
So keep playing as you're like,
watch the ship. The lights go off. They didn't deploy the anchors.
I want to get your whole commentary after we watch a little more, okay? That's what I want.
Really crazy to look at. As Laura Logan tweeted this afternoon, the GPS systems that drive these boats are not encrypted. Journalist Laura Logan, one of the best journalists in the world. The GPS systems that drive these boats are not encrypted. When a Navy ship crashed into a large cargo ship not that long ago, it was a cyber attack that made that happen. I know they're saying that this was not nefarious, but how do they know so quickly? Right, that's a great question. How do they know so quickly? We keep over the past week, we've sort of been joking about the Biden administration. Like, really, they were so quick to tell us that ISIS was responsible for the Russian theater attack, right? They told us within like minutes that that was the case. Yet they still can't tell us who killed John F. Kennedy. Still can't provide details about the 9/11 attacks. They can't tell us who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, but they were that fast to tell us that it was ISIS. They were lying to us, of course. So
the same way they immediately found the passports on 9/11.
Like, yeah, they're laying in dust.
All the rubble.
It's right there. There's a passport. Here are passports of this guy. Right? Look at this. It's not even charred or anything. But let's take a closer look at one last thing here. Why would explosions go off at these locations? So I've highlighted here in white where you're noticing the bridge. Now, I've slowed it down a little bit here. Here's the first collision, and you'll notice an explosion. And here you notice another one, and here another one. Watch this again. So here we go again. I'm going to replay the second time for you. So on the left side here, first collapse, and could this be some sort of, why would there be an explosion? Transformer blowing? Or is it something worse? And in this piece as well with an explosion. What is that? President Biden says nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. He travels this way all the time, you know, and there's nothing to see here. There's nothing nefarious as far as they can tell.
This is the Vantage holster right here. It is arguably the world's most comfortable holster. First thing you need to know about it,
we're going to rebuild that port together. That this was a terrible accident. At this time, we have no other indication, no other reason to believe there's any intentional act here.
No intentional act here. Okay. We do know that this same ship, though, had a history of events. This was in Antwerp in Belgium. This exact same ship back in 2016, the Dali, ran into a quay on July 11th, 2016, as it tries to exit the North Sea. So it kind of scraped the back of it. I wonder how often these things happen. Like, is this a common occurrence here? Or is this, you know, is this a rare thing for one of these massive container ships to do this? So it hit the quay. I mean, I know that they have those big rubber pylons to protect and so forth, but here it is. It was cleared for duty and went back out to sea. And of course, at the time it was under a different sea captain. It was not under the helm of a Ukrainian, different captain at the time when this happened back then as well. So that happened in 2016. So a black swan event. More that we don't know here. We're going to have to look more deeply into the harbor masters and the connections with the ship. Who was monitoring this the whole way? And was there any electrical cyber attack that took place on board the ship?
John, I want, of course, your thoroughgoing critique of what happened here. I mean, how can Biden come out and say there's no sign of any deliberate when the ship was directed, changed its course to hit the pylon? I mean, this is a problem. We have such an incompetent, corrupt administration to deal with the most serious crisis ever facing the United States. This is a catastrophe for the nation. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm glad you saw that one particular part, too. I've been watching this since the other morning when it was ongoing because I couldn't sleep, and I got up at like 2:30 in the morning, and there it is. But just to let people know, my background is not just Secret Service. I was also in U.S. Customs. And guess what? U.S. Customs handles the harbor area, aircraft, borders, harbor areas. They have to have a special pilot that goes on the ship if they come in so they can guide them through the deepest areas, the safest areas, and not get too close to the sides like through near NAS Coronado, right off Point Loma, things like that. And if they're going out, they have to have a pilot on there to take them directly out the specific areas. But I already saw problems with it when they were guided towards the bridge. They were headed towards that bridge originally, and all they had to do is divert just a little bit. If the power went out, the video clearly shows the power did go out, but you're talking, maybe 1,000 yards. I'm guessing 1,000 yards. Power goes out. They've got a problem. They're headed for one of the structures, the support structures. They should have deployed the anchors. I've already heard this information from other sources as well. They didn't deploy the anchors. They also have a pilot and a co-pilot plus the other pilot from the Bay Area to get them out. Nothing happened there. And another person, I guess this gentleman here was talking about the Michael Flynn thing encouraging, and then Laura Logan's name was brought up, that apparently the electronics or the guidance system through the computers was not tampered with or not. The cover stories are already beginning to happen on the news. They had one just this morning, right before the show, about another guy who was a former merchant marine, a captain, and he's talking about the type of the quality of the fuel was so bad, it's like a sludge. And then they put it in the ship, and it still has to go through their own filter systems before it gets processed to the pistons. Well, that's a sludge filtering system, not a steering system. It's not connected. So if it went out, the power went out, then it raises other questions. Now, additionally, they had 6 people that were allegedly working on the bridge at that location or near there. Who were they? Are those the same kind of guys that were over at 9/11 that came from the Mossad? Right? Raise the question. Did they have explosions? Well, it appeared that something went off, that right after the lights went off, the lights came back on, the boat steers directly towards the support beams, then an explosion. I'm sorry, where'd the explosion come from? There should be no explosions. It's a boat hitting a structure. That's it. It's a very strong boat. I've actually traveled on sea containers from Japan when I came back from Japan in 1970. The Oregon Mail, just for the record, Oregon Mail. They had sea containers on it. You couldn't go jogging around the place too much. It was very claustrophobic, and it took like 14 days. Never again. But I know what a sea container is, and I also cleared them at the harbors in San Diego and other ports of entry. So there's a lot of interesting factors coming up here, but when they come up pulling up a captain to give examples of, it was probably the fuel, it was dirty fuel, BS. Okay, that's the first lie. Then they're claiming, electrical problem, it went out. They could have turned off the generators, then it would have switched over to a backup generator, which would still keep their steering engaged, electronic or otherwise. Then it deliberately turns towards, or this way for you guys, towards the beam. That's a direct and deliberate act. Then an explosion. Where are the bodies? Are there any bodies? They still can't find them. That's going to interrupt the outgoing and incoming sea containers for up to a year. And the governor is stalling. I forget the black guy's name, the black governor. What's his name? He's stalling. He couldn't give a direct answer. If they have to repair the bridge, they could be out there right now, Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Military support, all this other stuff. They'd have closed it off for maybe a couple of months. They could get it done in 6 to 8 months, 9 months. It's going to go over a year. That's money, contracts. What did these guys come? These guys came from, and they're Ukrainian? And when people say it's the Dolly, you think, hello, Dolly, D-O-L-L-Y. No, Dali, D-A-L-I, from like Egypt and Middle East. So that's kind of my little rant there. But they're turning out. Every time they come up now, they're going to come up with another lie. Just watch for it. Go ahead.
Well, John, this is so blatant. It's so obvious, deliberate, and intentional to have Biden come out, or the fake Biden come out and say, no, it was just an accident. It's so grossly discrediting. I mean, but the guy, anyone who's been paying attention knows this is a phony and a fraud. It's not even the real Joe. But I think this is going to compound it. And as I say, we're being extorted by Ukraine on the one hand and by Mexico on the other. I mean, this is just outrageous, John.
Look at the relationship between Vladimir Zelensky and Biden. Who were the pilots on that ship? It would have been different if it was some other country, or maybe even Mexico or South America or Japan. Japan, Anjing. You've seen that name, Anjing. You know, I've seen them, but it's not. They're Ukrainian. All you have to do is add 1 + 1 = terrorism. 1 + 1, conspiracy to commit terrorist acts. Biden, Ukrainian connection, Vladimir Zelensky, and even these guys that were commenting about these surprises that will keep happening until they get paid. You know, it's crazy.
But yeah, and remember, Victoria Nuland, in her retirement speech, I mean, I'm so grateful to get her out of government because she's done so much devastation to the world on behalf of her Zionist motivation, said there were going to be some nasty surprises that were coming. Well, here you have one right there, nasty surprise.
And you got the exact word, too.
Yeah, and you got the Ukrainians threatening for more of these attacks if we don't shell out. I mean, just as blatant as a mafia crime family. I mean, the extortion is so egregious, John. I mean, God.
Yeah, I've been the victim of extortion myself, but that's an off subject off the show. But I'm looking at all the details, and what it also causes is more money from the government into that area. That bridge was built in the 70s, so it means it was still there. The Francis Scott Key, sorry, folks, say what his name really means. Wasn't there a guy that wrote a really cool song back in the 1777s or something?
A really cool song.
You see what I mean? And then, oh, that's the Key Bridge. Well, that's like joking about the bridge in the other bridge in Washington, D.C., where it goes into Roswell. You know, that bridge. And they make jokes about that. But
John,
it's the whole idea.
Stand by. We've hit a break, and we're going to be joined by Jerry Corsi. Very pleased to say.
All right. I haven't talked to Jerome in like 12 years.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome to the show Jerry Corsi, a well-known author. He's an expert on many different subjects. In fact, I pulled up a few of his books just to share. Here's what you'd find on Amazon. Jerry Corsi, PhD, founder and CEO of CorsiNation.com. His next book, this was published years ago, Coup d'etat, exposing deep state treason and the plan to reelect President Trump. He's also published Silence No More, How He Became a Political Prisoner of Mueller's Witch Hunt. His New York Times best-selling books included Dealing the Deep State of President Trump. He worked as a senior staff reporter for WND.com. He's worked at universities where he conducted research on federally funded grants from 1968 to 1981. Here are some of Jerry's books in the past. The Truth About Energy, Global Warming, and Climate Change. Hunting Hitler, New Scientific Evidence That Hitler Escaped Nazi Germany. Killing the Deep State of President Trump, who really killed Kennedy 50 years later. Studying New Revelations About JFK. Jerry, you've been covering a lot of bases, and I'm just so happy you teamed up with David, because when his monster book, I mean, it was the size of a phone directory, came out. I said to David, you need a more compact, conventional, reader-friendly version. And he turned to you. And the result, in my opinion, has been a stunning success.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. And David Manning is such a brilliant guy. And I've worked with him now for well over a couple of years, and I first interviewed him maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Now, he's both got a PhD in physics and an MD. He's been a radiation oncologist for over 40 years, and that's not an easy specialty. It's a very demanding specialty, as I'm sure you know, reading x-rays for cancer patients. And he writes, so it's above the head of the most readers, and the key, I thought, was to take what David said and not water it down at any rate. I wanted to present the full nature of what his arguments were, but so that it could be read by everybody and understood, and put it in, so, you know, put the technical material in appendices. So if somebody wanted to see the science, for instance, you know, the key to David's work is the optical density measurements of the x-rays. There's three extant x-rays in the archives, National Archives, of JFK's skull from the autopsy. And you do millimeter by millimeter, you take a densitometer, which is a scientific instrument, and it throws a beam of light through the x-ray, and you put a little arm down, and it measures what percentage of the light is getting through. That gives you a logarithmic number that expresses the nature of, you know, whether it's very opaque or whether it's very translucent, and a lot of light gets through or a little light gets through, then you know what you're looking at. But it's a scientific measure of how you read x-rays. But to explain that to the average person is difficult. So I came up with ways to do it by just saying, you know, your little charts that say, here's how you look at an x-ray, and make it simple for people to understand that if you're seeing something that it's white, that's probably bone. If you're seeing something that's black, it's a negative. That's empty. All the light came through and the silver nitrate turned black. So it's just learning how to, I've done this for my career,
take very complex subjects and try to make them so people can understand what they are, what's being discussed, what the issues are, without having to have a PhD in the subject.
Yes, yes. I think you've been very successful. David and I began collaborating in 1992 before he entered the National Archive for the very first time. And he told me he thought he'd find evidence of a second shot to the head and that the autopsy x-rays had been altered. And indeed, he found both. The technique you're describing, optical densitometry, involves measuring the amount of light exposed on the x-ray where the relative density of the object being x-rayed absorbs more x-rays the more it's dense and therefore leaves a lighter image, thus, as you say, where the white areas that would be very dense objects. So you can calculate the relative density. And in this case, he knew from his experience going in that the x-rays they had showed too much contrast between the dark and light objects. I mean, hundreds of times greater contrast than would be the case if they were authentic and genuine. And what he did was to apply that technique. And as you know, he was myopic at the time. He could barely see, but it enabled him to focus on all these little areas of the x-ray. And it was a huge benefit. So much of the success is because he had this very peculiar condition, which has now been corrected by cataract surgery. But it would have been far, far more difficult for him to perform those tasks today, post-cataract surgery, than at the time. I was so glad John Carman could join us today, Jerry, because John has a background in the Secret Service. And since, a lot of what happened in Dealey Plaza was accountable to the Secret Service, where when Nigel Turner did The Men Who Killed Kennedy, the seventh installment, he invited me and David and others in my collaborative group to participate, and he asked me to enumerate 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up with a hit, including leaving two men behind at Love Field, not having the manhole covers welded down, not having the windows shut, not having the crowd control back from the street, changing the route heading into Dealey Plaza, all among the indications of how they were setting him up. And of course, actually the driver, William Greer, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure Jack would be whacked. And then after, of course, at Parkland, they moved the vehicle when individuals noticed this hole in the windshield. At Bethesda, they gathered the x-rays and the photographs after they had been developed, so they were not available to the public. And the next time we get access, they have been altered and changed. In fact, as you well know, David has established that none of the x-rays in the National Archives are authentic originals. They are all duplicates and appear to have been altered one way or another. John, I want you to add in a few words here as we continue our conversation with Jerry.
And also, John and I have worked together before. We've communicated before, and I know John and have respected his career. So, John, it's good to see you again. Thank you.
Yeah, good to see you. I think the other guy was Joseph Farah.
Yes, Joseph Farah was my boss for many years at World Net Daily. I worked for him from 2004 to about 2016. So, and Joseph Farah, I have always had great respect for Joseph Farah.
Hey, just so you guys were mentioning x-rays, I happen to always keep a piece of Velostat because I'm experimenting with the Michael Minkin stuff. And you can't put a light through it. So right. What do you call that, right? I mean, I'm putting a light.
Called very opaque.
Very opaque. It's blocking. It's for telepathic stuff that blocks telepathic issues.
Right.
Jim Mars called me back in 95 when I was still at Customs and I was on injury leave. That's when I was listening to Art Bell. I knew Art Bell, Philip J. Corso, a bunch of people since 95. But Jim Mars specifically called me to talk about Dealey Plaza. And he was talking about this stuff, about the storm drain covers, which Jim, rightfully and very studiously pulled up on that comment, because a lot of people don't get it. Ever since Dallas in 63, all the storm drain covers on any parade route or alternate route have to be welded shut. Now, why is that? So you have to ask that lawyer question. Well, why is that, John? Or why is that, whoever? Well, you think maybe somebody could probably pop a round. And to this day, people say, oh, you couldn't even get into the storm drain where the Stemmons Freeway sign was. And I've had other people back and forth, because there was a guy named Jack Lawrence who is still being covered up, still to this day. They'll show 8 shooters and all this other stuff. I actually know a couple of people that were in that area nowadays, not when I was 10 years old, by the way, because I was only 10 and 63. That's my little alibi, although I was trained to shoot by Marines, but that's another story. Boy Scout stuff, you know, but it's very interesting that people still are covering that stuff up, because it goes back to Poppy Bush. It goes to all these other connections, the CIA, the military industrial complex, and so on and so forth. And then maybe he was going to talk about aliens. Not sure about that one. That's on the extreme. Ask Marilyn Monroe, and she was assassinated. So it's like that movie. I think one of the best movies I watched was the one with Burt Lancaster.
Executive Action. Executive Action.
Thank you, Jim. It was an excellent movie. And the odds of all these witnesses being killed off were infinitesimal, impossible. And all those people in Dallas weren't what they claimed they were. They had badges walking around that were not real. They were snatching up cameras. They were picking up evidence. The Zapruder film. Okay, let me get into my Secret Service stuff. When I was recruited in Washington, D.C. from San Diego, full background check takes me a year. Everybody else, they probably do it in 3 months. Mine takes a full year because I was military family, top secret military bases since I was born, and transferred around every 3 years. I felt like I worked out of that other agency out of Langley. So when I went back there, our training was 19 weeks of federal law enforcement training before it was transferred down to Georgia by Carter. And then we had specialized training at Beltsville, which I think they renamed it the Jim Raleigh Center thing. Yeah, there's another name. They showed us, they had a day where the agent was going to come out specifically to talk about the JFK stuff. What a sham. He came out. He had a video of the Zapruder film, the altered Zapruder film, and frame 313, which was prophetically connected to my name and numbers. That's another subject. Frame 313 has always been altered because they don't want you to see the blood splatter, the travel from the angle, which I'm sure, well, actually, I should show it this way. That's where it's coming from. That's the angle. Okay. And then they cover it up. Well, we couldn't even ask the guy any questions. He says the official agency answer is the Warren Commission report. We were so disappointed.
Well,
I had guys that were ex-Marines that were talking about, oh, yeah, he had a picture of Oswald at the depository standing on the steps at the time of the shooting, all these other things that I know about. I studied this stuff since I was 10, but they didn't want to talk about it. The Zapruder film was altered. That was the altered film. I didn't see the actual film until 30 plus years, like in 95 when I was on injury leave. I started picking up DVDs and transferring my VHS to DVDs. So I got to look at stuff like a James Files thing, the Zapruder film, all these other ones. And I'm not a JFK nut or somebody who's a conspiracy nut. I look at the evidence. I research it. If I see something, I can't let go because I'm being guided towards these facts. So there's a lot of questions being asked and nobody's answering.
Well, John,
talked to Jim Garrison, and Jim Garrison before he died in 91, 92. And he basically said, stay healthy, John. Don't smoke. Don't drink. I don't anyway. Because in 75 years, they're supposed to release the information, which was a couple of years ago when Trump was around. And because Poppy Bush was dying, they delayed it another, 90 days?
Yeah.
They're still withholding evidence.
John, you're absolutely right. Jerry, one of the most fascinating to me parts of this, of course, was the discussion of the third shot to the head. There'd been a long-standing debate about whether Jack had been hit in the head from the above-ground sewer opening at the intersection of the Triple Underpass and the Brigand Fence, or from the curbside sewer opening. And David and I had actually gone there. David had climbed in and ascertained that the trajectory was wrong. for the entry shot around the right temple. Now, it turns out that the debate has been resolved by his additional research, including with Doug Horn, that there's been this third shot to the head, which David has ascertained came from the suicide opening, where the two shots hit at approximately the same time, blew his brains out the back of his head, and ejecta, not as shown in frame 313, which John Costello has demonstrated is an artifact. It's a merge of the, you know, two shots. We have the shot from the back of the head where he slumped forward, then Jackie's up, and then when he's hit in the head and his brain's blown out, he just slumps to the left. That, of course, is not what we see in the accident Zapruder film, which I have set up for us to discuss. But given that David and I had been there and he'd been into the curbside sewer opening, I was just fascinated that he had now determined that that was the source of that third shot to the head. Jerry.
Well, I think the main focus for me was that David, with his study of the x-rays, could prove, first of all, that they were forged. And that's a major issue, that the three skull x-rays are forged. That's indisputable. And he specifically did the white patch on the lateral x-ray, the side view, there's a right lateral, there's a left lateral. They each have this big white patch at the back. And in fact, Jim, if you want to let me share the screens, I can pull the book up and I can show you some of the pages while we're talking about it.
Sure. Let me.
Not Officer Tibbet, right?
No, not Officer Tibbet. No. But let me get this here. Just take me.
Go ahead, Jerry. I've made you a host.
Yeah, I'm going to find the file here and I'll get it in front of me, and then we'll go. But it, the key thing to me was, okay, so the X-rays are forged. And I want to show you the white patch.
He calls it area P for patch.
Area P for patch. This is, to me, first of all, clear evidence that there's been not only alteration of the evidence, but the government did it, because the government's been in control of this data for some time. The government's always had control of the data. No one else has ever had control of the X-rays except the government. So if they were forged, the government forged them. It's going to take a minute for this file to load, because it's a very long file.
Can I make
I've got it, Jerry. I've got area P already in the PowerPoint.
Okay,
if you want.
Well, you can put it up.
John, put it up. Yeah, I'll recapture host. Go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to make a comment that kind of dovetails with what Jerry was saying. And I left Secret Service in 77 because there were problems at the Secret Service and the White House. I'm the guy that interviewed Hinckley in front of the White House in 76 and all these other incidents, and they kept failing and failing and failing. They weren't doing what they should have done. Well, there we go.
Here's the book we're talking about. The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the Final Analysis, Forensic Analysis of the JFK Autopsy X-rays and the Harper Fragment. We know the official story, three shots from above and behind. It was hokum from the beginning. In fact, Jerry, I don't know if you went back and looked at See It Now, but on NBC, they were reporting two shots over radio and television in great detail. One, a small, clean puncture wound to the throat. The other, the shot to the right temple. I mean, after all, Malcolm Palgrave, the acting press secretary, had already announced he was killed, a simple matter of a bullet right through the head, pointing to his right temple.
Pointing right to his right temple to say that, exactly.
Yes.
So the stories, if you follow the stories, they change. First, it was a Mauser that was found in the sixth floor. They found a Mauser rifle, which stamped right on the trigger mechanism. I mean, anybody who has any familiarity with weapons knows you don't mistake a Mauser. And then it suddenly becomes a Mannlicher-Carcano rifle, which is, a rifle that no reasonable person would ever use to do anything. Never worked. It had a misaligned scope.
Yep.
Besides the fact anybody who's ever shot a weapon knows that a scope at that distance is actually a detriment. I mean, you have to acquire the target. It's hard to acquire a target that close with a scope. You want to do a distant target. You don't want to take a shot that's yards and yards away. Okay, a scope is fine. But this was a very short-range shot that could easily have been scoped with the
rifle itself without the use of a high-powered scope. So the whole thing was really a charade. It was a manufactured narrative to draw people in and come to the predetermined conclusion the government wanted you to come to. Now, what David Manning did by going back to the x-rays is he took the best available evidence, the x-rays themselves. And if they're forged, that's a major problem for the government. Okay, and he finds this big white spot on the lateral x-rays. And by the way, there's two lateral x-rays.
Keep talking and I'll pull it up. Yeah, keep talking.
Yeah, the white spot is so impossibly white, you know, that it could not possibly be real because there's an x-ray has a natural range of natural light coming through it, which is like from 0.5.
Here
which means
that Malcolm
killed off.
Yeah,
that's killed off.
There may the witnesses reporting where they saw the blowout at the back of the head. Here's a drawing by Robert McClellan. This is by Charles Crenshaw. Here's where I actually found you could see the blowout in frame 374. Yes. And here we have these. This is area P, Jerry. Go right ahead. This is what David defined.
It's impossibly white.
So yes.
In other words, it's like a building that's too tall. You can't build a 10-mile-tall building, and that's just not possible. So that white area, which is whiter than the Petrie's bone, which is down by the ear,
right?
That's the densest bone in the skull. So if you get, you know, this reading, which is
here's a PB,
you know that this was an attempt to mask an area of light so that it would turn out white on the negative, and on the X-ray, and so therefore you're taking. You're either hiding something under that patch or you're trying to draw attention away from it to go to the front of the head.
Yes.
Where they, you know, well, again,
even on that photo, the rear of the head is intact.
Here, right. Yeah.
Well, but see, you can see up those two little arrows that's where the Harper fragment begins to come out right there. There's a disconnect in the skull. And, but you're right, Jim. I think I've agreed with you that the frame you've identified is the back of the head wound. It's just as Clint Hill is coming onto the car. And the officer, Officer Hargis, who's the inbound motorcycle to the left of the limousine, behind it, gets splattered with Kennedy's brain, his brain tissue, blood, skull, hair. He sits so hard he thinks that he's hit.
Yeah.
So that's clearly... Okay, and that shot, which Dr. Manning has validated, comes from a shot to the right temple. It's an oblique shot. You can see in the x-ray the keyhole fracture that an oblique shot makes when it enters the skull, and it blew out the back of his head. So at Parkland, the shot that John referred to earlier that came through the windshield, which was actually clearly, anybody who knows anything about ballistics, was a frontal shot. Because if you looked at that windshield, the witnesses said it was smooth on the outside. So there's a puncture where the bullet comes through it. And the beveling of the glass is on the inside. That's how a bullet hits safety glass. In fact, Dr. Manning thinks that it was one of the shreds of glass that hit Kennedy's throat. But it was a puncture wound. It was a small, like pencil shaped wound, which is typical of an entrance wound. And the back of the head blown out is typical of an exit wound. And these doctors, the medical personnel at Parkland, these were very experienced doctors. They'd seen gunshot wounds almost every day. You know, their reputations depended upon being able to identify quickly, is this an entrance wound? Is it an exit wound? What's the nature of the damage? And the every one of those pictures with people at Parkland put their hand in the same place, back right hand part of their head, the occipital bone, and said that was blown out. Yeah, but back there, the size of a grapefruit, right back, the occipital bone back here. And they could look down into the brain. They saw brain tissue, huge amounts of brain tissue gone. They saw that the cerebellum, which is a part of the brain at the very back, different in color from the rest of the brain, was hanging out. The skull was jagged. It had been blown out. It was sharp and jagged. So these doctors look at this and they say, you know, this guy's dead. But he's the president of the United States. It's the emergency room.
So they do everything they can to try to save his life, even though it's futile. They have to have done everything they could do to be held not accountable for having done something wrong. So they do a tracheotomy on the throat wound, which involves a very narrow, little, small incision to get the tracheotomy going. And these doctors are expert at this. Okay, and finally, they're doing heart massage to try to get Kennedy's heart going. One of the doctors says, wait a minute, stop. His brains are on the floor. You're not going to, let's stop this. You know, we're doing pointless things at this point. So they only worked on Kennedy about 20 minutes. And they rushing into the, in panic, knowing it was the president of the United States, but they knew he was dead. And they knew, and they did not turn him over to examine the wounds. In fact, Earl Rose shows up at the trauma room one. He's the guy at the Parkland Hospital who's assigned to do the autopsy, and he's ready there to collect the body. He's going to do all the analysis of the wounds. But instead, they get a ceremonial casket brought in. They call a local funeral home, and the Secret Service at gunpoint make sure Jack Kennedy's body is in that ceremonial casket, and they put Dr. Rose up against the wall, and they say, we're taking this body. They got their guns pulled. So at gunpoint, when this was not a federal murder case, killing the president at that time was not against federal law, it was against state law, and Dr. Earl Rose had the authority to do the autopsy. But the Secret Service knew they had to get the body out of there because they didn't want an illegitimate autopsy done. They couldn't risk it. The Secret Service had been on the site. They knew he was hit from the front. Clearly, when Clint Hill grabbed onto the back of the limousine and saw the Jack Kennedy's brains on the trunk, not on the hood, on the trunk, nobody had to think this was a frontal shot.
Hold that thought. We got a break. We'll return with Jerry Corsi and John Carman right after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Screen again. I pulled up some pictures I want to show you on the shot to the forehead.
Sure.
Hey, can I add a comment about the limo?
Yeah, of course, sure. Scott, and I know you you actually saw the limousine. Go ahead, tell us.
That's correct. When I was in Secret Service, they had a place at 1310 L Street. It's no longer under Secret Service jurisdiction or protection or whatever. They had to go to a larger building somewhere else. The actual vehicle was kept like three levels below in the garage. And I'm thinking about this hindsight and go, wait a minute. After all these years, this is during Nixon just left August 9th, 74. I came on September 3rd, 74. I think Nixon came back to clean out his locker or something. Dude. But Gerald Ford, you remember that guy, the obscure congressman from Michigan? And the other guy, Earl Warren, the guy that went to visit some guy over in Dallas at the city jail, Jack Ruby joke, right? Well, what's interesting is when we went down there, they specifically showed it to us, but I went to go up and touch it and look around. The supervisor said, well, don't get inside and don't touch it. Oh, okay. But it wasn't covered up. It didn't have a tarp on it. Well, it was open.
But, John, it was rebuilt. I mean, Lyndon had the original vehicle stripped down to bare metal and rebuilt. So you're just looking at a refurbish. They destroyed all the evidence by tearing it down to bare metal.
Exactly. And if I had a chance, I would have pulled out my handkerchief, gone into the back seat, and swiped it somewhere to get some swatch of something or dug around. Because, you know, there might have been tens of hundreds of bullets laying around like that other agent that claimed he found a bullet and went and put it on the stretcher later, Joe. I'm being sarcastic, but I know what I'm saying. But it's interesting because after I left in 77, October, just to give you a time frame, and I did really good jobs, but I saw so many problems connected to this stuff, it really made me think. And I had been in the Oval Office. I had been to the Resolute Desk. I used to protect everything from underground, top level to on the roofs, next to the buildings, the Blair House, the EOB. There's something wrong with the fact that they kept that vehicle there all those years. That's 11 years later.
Well,
think about it.
Well, who wanted to? I mean, it was an historic artifact, even though it was rebuilt. I mean, this was.
Right. But the point is, they didn't want it out in access to other areas where maybe somebody else might get access to something that they're not aware of. But
well, there was
originally LBJ had it fixed.
There was nothing left of any forensic interest whatsoever.
Guess where they have the limousines built? Bulletproof limousines. Guess what state that are built in?
Michigan.
Michigan.
Texas.
Oh, Texas.
Yeah, they get the contracts. You know, I don't know. You know, it's just kind of weird. Oh, you know, maybe there's a connection. But
okay, hang on. I want Jerry. Jerry, go ahead. Do your screen share.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me share my screen here, and I want to show.
I made you
host. Let's take a look at the a couple of the evidence here of the bullet wounds. This is Dr. Michael Chesser, who went in and did his own optical density measurements, which confirmed Dr. Mantic's measurements independently done, and identified the bullet tracking and the evidence in the x-ray, the skull x-rays, that Jack Kennedy was shot from the front. And Dr. Mantic and Dr. Chesser agree. Now, in this shot, you can see where there's a little faint blue over here. My cursor is showing you that's where the bullet entered. Right front, that's the forehead. This would be the front of JFK's, and this is the back. So it entered right here at the forehead, and there's a trail of bullets across the top. Now, we've got some better pictures of that, but here, the entrance had this little bevel. That's where the entrance occurred from the shot. And you can see a lot of dust-like fragments from the bullet when it first entered. That's typical of a bullet entering an entry wound, where at the start of the entry wound and the bullet is beginning to fragment, it starts fragmenting in these little dust-like specks. As the bullet proceeds through the head, and this one is a good, we put them in yellow, you can see all the fragments along this blue line that are the frontal shot to the forehead. What you'll notice is that the largest fragment is at the back. And so the smaller fragments are at the front. Now, that's clearly physics, because the largest fragment of a bullet breaking up is heaviest, and it has the most momentum, therefore it'll travel the farthest. You'll also notice up here, it does not exit. That skull is intact. There's no breakage of that skull. So that's clearly a frontal shot. And this was a problem for the autopsy. You know, they evidently couldn't get rid of these bullet fragments, because they were probably mercury, and you can't remove the mercury like you could remove metal. So they had to leave these in the skull when the x-ray showed it, and they couldn't remove those in the pre-autopsy surgery. As we point out in the book, Jack Kennedy's body arrived at the Bethesda morgue on the night of the assassination an hour and a half before the official autopsy started, and he arrived in a steel shipping casket in the body bag, which is not how Jack Kennedy's body left Dallas, left in a ceremonial casket wrapped in sheets. So there was pre-autopsy surgery, and the two, Siegbert and O'Neill, two of the FBI agents, who attended the autopsy, put this in their 302 report, which is their field report from any field investigation. And neither Siegbert nor O'Neill were medically trained, so obviously one of the doctors said, when Jack Kennedy was taken out of the ceremonial casket to begin the official autopsy with the gallery, the damage to his head was so massive, the gallery gasped. And I guess Hugh must have said, well, there was pre-autopsy surgery done on the skull, which means the wounds were altered. Now, this, however, is clear indication yet in the x-ray of the frontal shot to the forehead. As we go down a little bit further, and we write about it, this is the book in before it was typeset. You also have evidence. So this is what the throat wound looked like. And it's like what the wound would have looked like, both entrance wounds. But as we analyze it, and we say that the shot that hit the side of the head, I can search for the Harper fragment, which is where we discussed that, so that you can see that it entered at the ear, and there is a keyhole fracture, which makes it clear that that was the entry point by the ear. I'm trying to find the picture on that. This is what the Harper fragment looks like. It was a trapezoid-shaped fragment, and it blew out the back of the head, with the shot to the ear. And as we go through this in more detail, you can see that I think at some point or other I have in here the pictures of the, these were the frontal shot. These are approximately where the shot to the back of the head happened, which was further up the highway from where the shooting started. Okay, now I'm going to stop sharing the screen, but I wanted to make it clear that there is absolutely unmistakable evidence from the bullet fragment trail of the frontal shot to the forehead that it was clear that was one frontal shot destroys the entire narrative of the Warren Commission. The blowout to the back of the head from the shot to the side of the head makes it there were at least two shooters because these angles were differently. The shot that came through the windshield looks like it came from the vicinity of the south side of Dealey Plaza, across from the grassy knoll. The triple underpass goes through both sides of Dealey Plaza. There's a traffic moving one direction, traffic moving another direction, east and west. And above the triple underpass is a railroad yard. There's a concrete fence there. And there was a shooter behind that fence, evidently, which can be seen in the Dillard photographs. I can try to show you that as well in a minute. But the point is, in this book, what I stuck to is saying, okay, and Jim, you go back, you had before where the three shots were coming on a head figure in your PowerPoint.
Yeah.
And
I'll have to regain. Yeah, hang on a second.
Because it's clear in terms of where exactly the shots came from or who was shooting. I tried in this book to writing it to only stick to things that we could absolutely prove. In other words, I didn't want the book to be shot down. That's it right there. You can see that the three shots, the low angle shot in the back of the head, the yellow, the green, which is the shot in the temporal bone right by the ear and blew out the back of the head, the Harper fragment, and the red is where the frontal shot occurred. Now, what this means is that and especially with the windshield shot and the throat, that puts a shooter over there on the other side of Dealey Plaza, up by the railroad yard and the triple underpass. There was also clearly a shooter in the vicinity of the grassy knoll. And there was a shooter low angle behind Kennedy, which means there was a shooter in the Daltex building, most likely. Now, Jim, we didn't get into saying there's two things we avoided in this book. One is we didn't want to name shooters because that was, again, I didn't want something in the book somebody could object to.
Yeah.
So, in other words, we said that we stuck to the hard evidence that we could prove. And therefore, it's clear there were three shooters. It's clear that there were frontal shots. And that means it was a conspiracy. Okay, now, who the shooters were, first of all, these had to be top professional shooters. You're shooting at the President of the United States. This is emotions for the ordinary person are going to be running wild. You have to have a cold-blooded killer who's looking at this as a technical operation and has done this before. The car is moving down Elm Street to the triple underpass. It's about a 3-degree decline down, and it's winding. So there's a wind in the highway, the Elm Street, as it gets down to the triple underpass. That's a difficult shot. That's a very difficult shot. And it would take top marksmen to be able to scope it, not with a scope, manually, and get that shot in the right trajectory. So secondly, in terms of the manhole and the sewers or whether the shooter was in the grassy knoll, we don't get into that because, again, that's area that can be debated, and we don't have the same with the x-rays. This is absolute scientific proof. This is indisputable. The x-rays were altered. They show evidence of three shots, two to the front. That's the end of the case. From there, now we've got lots of things. Now it reframes it. In other words, now what we know from my book, from David, David's work, is that the government lied. The government had a setup staged. The government had this evidence planted on the sixth floor corner window of the Texas School Book Depository. Now, a couple things went wrong. Number one, Elchins, who was an AP photographer,
just happened to be standing on Elm Street in front of the limousine, and he snapped a picture as Jack Kennedy was hit in the neck, and you can see his arms coming up to the neck, and you see the Texas School Book Depository behind the car. So you can't say that the Jack Kennedy was shot from the front. The Texas School Book Depository is behind him in the Alton's picture, and that's where Utley Harvey Oswald was supposed to have been shooting. That's where the setup was in the Cypher's net. Similarly, in the Zapruder film, you can see that the shooting begins after Jack Kennedy has passed the Texas School Book Depository. Now, when they took the body from Parkland and they flew it to Andrews Air Force Base in Air Force One after Johnson was sworn in as president, which took time, didn't get there until early evening into Washington. Within an hour after the assassination, they had picked up Lee Harvey Oswald, and the story was already broadcast. The police radio, dispatch radio, had within minutes Oswald's description. They were broadcasting it. Oswald was apprehended. They brought him in. They say, you know, you've got Wade and these other guys for the Dallas Police Department saying he is the assassin. We found the rifle. They display the rifle. They say we had three shells. They take a picture of the sniper's nest, even though they'd rearranged the boxes. You know, those were not that was not the way the boxes were when the shooting happened on that floor. But the setup is there. So people are told, this is what you believe. Lee Harvey Oswald did it with the Mannlicher Carcano rifle that he bought mail order. And Lee Harvey Oswald is saying, I didn't shoot anybody. He fails the paraffin test. He has the identification as Wald for Heidel. He's saying, it's not what you think it is at all. He doesn't answer. He said, well, who's Heidel? I said, you guys are the cops. You guys figure it out. He acts as if in fact, we know now he was working with the CIA and the FBI. He said, I'm waiting for somebody to come forward. You know, I don't have a lawyer here. I'm a patsy. But the broadcast image was of the Jim Carrey Truman Show, the architected reality that had been set up in advance to create a false narrative. And who created it? The CIA created it. The Secret Service participated. The Secret Service was altering evidence with the limousine to begin with. All this packaged information is coming out immediately about Lee Harvey Oswald. And by the time the airplane lands, they've got a problem because the doctors at Bethesda now know that the doctors at Parkland, about an hour after Kennedy was pronounced dead, gave a press conference. And doctors Malcolm Perry, who did the tracheotomy, and Kemp Clark said Jack Kennedy was shot from the front. They made that absolutely clear. They said it 8 or 9 times during that press conference. That press conference was broadcast nationally. After that, the airplane scene, the airplane leaves Love Field. Now we've got Lee Harvey Oswald arrested. He's being paraded to the media. Said he's the guy who shot 6th floor. We have all the pictures being taken of the 6th floor. They find what they claim is the Mannlicher Carcano rifle. By the way, there's no proof that Oswald ever picked that rifle up or that he actually did order that rifle. Okay, so, but conveniently, it's mail order. And they've got all this information about he got this from this mail order catalog. All this information is being put out by Walter Cronkite and the media as they're being fed to that information from the government. And they're broadcasting it uncritically, trying to keep up with the story. So when the plane lands, Boswell and Hume, who are the two Navy doctors who are going to do the autopsy, know they got a problem. Because the government knows the shots were from the front. So they have to arrange to get Jack Kennedy's body off of Air Force One to the autopsy before it occurs, smuggled into the morgue. And then they do. And Boswell and Hume said, you alter those wounds because we can't have any traces of frontal shots. Got a big problem. They got the clear puncture wound at the forehead. Got the blowout in the back of the head. So what they do is they do massive surgery on the head. They butcher the parietal bone, which is the top of the head. They make massive incisions to obscure the entry wound of the forehead. They enlarge the throat wound to make it look like an exit wound. They fundamentally alter the body before the autopsy began, because the Navy crew who was there, the Navy corpsman who were going to attend the autopsy, who were seeing and brought in this casket, and the, you know, the, here comes in a casket, and it's in a shipping casket, and they open up the, Jack Kennedy's body is in a body bag. Well, these Navy guys were astounded. I mean, this is not the way you ship the body of the President of the United States. And they'd all seen the ceremonial casket get unloaded at Air Force One, at Andrews Air Force Base, because that was broadcast. Okay, so the government's got a problem. They have to alter the wounds. And all night long, we document this from the book. And by the way, Douglas Horn did outstanding work in the Assassinations Records Review Board, that five volumes that he did. And we consulted with him extensively, David and I, to make sure we got it right. Because what Douglas Horn documents is there were three different casket entries. First of all, this shipping casket and the body bag. They take in this ante room to the gallery morgue. They begin doing pre-autopsy surgery. They got an hour and a half to do it. And then the casket is in this Navy ambulance at Andrews Air Force Base. We see the casket off the airplane, loaded into the ambulance. Jackie Kennedy gets in the back. Bobby Kennedy gets in with them. They drive off to Bethesda. That arrives at the morgue about 7:17 in the evening. 6:30, the silver shipping casket arrives. 7:17, the limousine pulls up in front, and Jackie Kennedy gets out. Bobby Kennedy gets out. They go in the front door to Bethesda Navy Hospital. They go up to a private waiting room for VIPs. The two guys driving that Navy ambulance were the two guys who drove the limousine, Kellerman and Greer. They don't know where the back of the morgue is. And here come Siebert and O'Neill in their FBI car, and they know where the back, and they say, let's follow us. They go around to the back of the morgue, and Kellerman and Greer and Siebert and O'Neill bring in the ceremonial casket, and they're told to leave. So the ceremonial casket is now there. After they finish the pre-autopsy surgery, they get the body back in the ceremonial casket. Now, the honor guard, which was at Andrews Air Force Base to be the official soldiers escorting the casket, as you know, the Army, Navy, Marine soldiers trained to be honor guard in their full uniform. Well, the ambulance goes off to Bethesda from, you know, with Bobby and Jacqueline Kennedy in it. And the honor guard takes another car. And by the way, one of the commanders is Captain Galloway, takes another Navy ambulance from Bethesda. And the honor guard follows this fake ambulance, Galloway, around the city for a while, and they're lost. So finally, they show up at about 8 o'clock. Body's back in the ceremonial casket. The metal casket's gone. The body bag is gone. They think that this is the casket that arrived directly from Air Force One. Honor Guard carries it in. They take, you know, there's Boswell Hume beginning the autopsy. There's the gallery. They take the body out, and suddenly everybody's aghast at all this damage done to Jack Kennedy's head, because that was not reported at Parkland. And what do they conclude? They say there was pre-autopsy surgery, and the agents write it in their report. So this was a mess from the government's point of view, and they were trying constantly to cover it up, which involves now the Secret Service, the CIA. Guess who's at the autopsy, smoking a cigar? Curtis LeMay of the Joint Chiefs. There's Army personnel there. They're directing the autopsy, telling the doctors what they can and can't do. So now we got the military involved. Okay, immediately we got J. Edgar Hoover wanting to talk on the phone with Lyndon Johnson and trying to figure it out. J. Edgar Hoover thinks Jack Kennedy was shot twice. Two bullets hit him. They think maybe a separate bullet hit John Connolly. So they've got three bullets. That's all they've got to work with, because that's all the shells that were found. That's a Procrustean bed. They got to make the story fit the evidence now. They're stuck. And so What they realized in all this mess was that this guy, James Tague, who was standing on the other side of a triple underpass underneath the shooter there, was nicked in the cheek by one of the bullets. So now they got another problem. That means one bullet went astray and hit James Tague. Plus they hit the curb. They saw the curb and they saw another manhole that had a bullet tracing on it. And Tague was hit. So they only got two shots. But they know that Kennedy had a wound in his back. He had a wound in his throat. He had head wounds. And John Connolly had a wound in his back. It went through his arm that ended up in his leg. Now, how do you do this with two shots? And so the doctors at Bethesda write three separate autopsy reports. They rip them up. They're on the phone all night long, badgering the doctors at Parkland. They tell Dr. Malcolm Perry that if he doesn't change his story and admit that he might have been wrong, they're going to revoke his medical certification. He'll never practice law. He's in his 30s, got little children. They're going to take away his livelihood. They pressure him into where he has to change his story. He comes in the next day, and this nurse says, "You look horrible, doctor." He says, "I was on the phone all night with Bethesda, and they wanted me to change my story." So finally, Hume and Boswell and another pathologist, Fink, who was an Army pathologist, brought in to assist, write up their report, and they say that Jack Kennedy was hit once in the back of the head that blew out the front. They say that he was hit in the back, and that shot went out the front of his throat and did a little skip and dance and went and hit Connolly in the shoulder at back, went through and hit, broke Connolly's wrist, and ended up in his shoulder, his leg. That's bullet 399, and it's pristine. There's hardly any lead missing from it. And Arlen Specter, who was on the prosecutor's team, who's part of the Warren Commission, has to make this story stick. And the story is preposterous to anybody who knows anything about ballistics. And it is not the way it happened. But that's the story that was sold to the American people. Now, the key point of this book that I've written with Dr. Mantic is to make the people aware the government lies. The government creates narratives that they present to you as if this is the truth. And then the government is covering up its own complicity in having assassinated someone, having 9/11 blowing up buildings, having airplanes fly into buildings, assassinations, the Guatemala assassination for a banana company, Mossadegh in Iraq, Lumumba in Africa. The CIA is all over the world doing nefarious things and has never stopped until this day. Why do we have 100 CIA outposts for 10 years on the border with Ukraine and Russia after the Maidan rebellion, and the CIA isn't supposed to be there? What's the CIA doing over there? Wherever the State Department is, the CIA is. And I want to talk about Alan Dulles and John Dulles and how they created this military-industrial deep state where the CIA and the State Department cooperate, and they're creating narratives, read lies, that are these manufactured scenes like a play, and they sell these manufacturing scenes as if they were the truth, and they hide up their own complicity.
Jerry, we turn to the Dulles brothers, and for whatever reason, the break at the bottom of the hour hasn't hit us, so we can continue our conversation. Let me add a few clarifying comments. David Lifton understood what had happened to the body, that it had been taken out of the bronze ceremonial casket on Air Force One, probably when Lyndon Johnson was being sworn in a body bag and put in a compartment there of the plane where it was offloaded at Andrews onto a helicopter and then flown to Walter Reed, where the best pathologists in the military removed metal fragments that may have been of different caliber because each shooter was using his preferred weapon, that not more than the fragments intended to be found with a body remained, even though Dennis David recorded multiple fragments that were more than consistent with a Warren report.
He was one of the Navy Corpsmen who was at Bethesda.
Yeah, he was the NCO who was responsible for checking people in and out. And it was transported in a black hearse to the back of the morgue And as you describe, a gray, pinkish gray shipping cactus, it was, the body was inside a body bag, and it was on the autopsy table, already undergoing autopsy when the Gray Navy ambulance with Jackie showed up. Now, I had correspondence with Gerald Custer, which I shared with David. He was the radiation tech who actually took the x-rays. And he reported how he was halfway upstairs to have these x-rays, which were exposed but not yet developed, when he saw the entourage coming up to Bethesda. He thought, what in the world's going on? Because Jack was already in the morgue undergoing autopsy. So that was a really important facet of this whole deception that David Lifton had sorted out early on. Fascinating part of it. John, I know you have a lot of things you want to add. Go ahead and throw in a few. Yeah.
I want John to add, and Douglas Horn went to, with the Assassinations Records Review Board after the Oliver Stone movie in the 1991, it operated for several years in 1990, and his five volumes on the Inside the ARB, Douglas Horn, when they interviewed all these Navy corpsmen, they took depositions. They've got all the records they could get. So this whole charade, this whole farce of the autopsy and the pre-autopsy surgery is now not conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact. And again, we did document that in the book because we've got documentary evidence. We've got evidentiary testimony. It fits together in terms of how the x-rays were altered.
But
we begin this book with scientific data. That's the bedrock of the book.
Yes.
Then the other parts of the narrative, we show how what people did see fit into what really happened, not the government narrative. That's the key point. That's how this book is put together. John?
Now, first, it was Commander Humes who actually performed cranial surgery to the top of the head to extend the fist side blowout. So it took out the whole top of the head and is described in mathematical detail in the Bethesda autopsy report, which is a reason I'm dumbfounded by. When the House Select Committee on Investigation reinvestigated in 1977-78 and issued their final report in 79, they had reconstituted the back of the head. So it's all together. They moved the entry wound at the external occipital protuberance to the crown of the head, and it's not even consistent with a Harper fragment. And it's just shocking how blatantly the government has lied to the American people. It's as though they were redoing the cover-up from the beginning, and they thought they'd redo it better. Just embarrassing. John, go ahead.
Well, I wasn't sure if we're going to go on a break, but I was typing a few notes off to the side there. I don't know if Mr. Corsi is going to address the alleged body switch with Officer Tippett's body theory. And also, Gerald Ford also allegedly changed the location of the back injury about 6 inches in another area. So,
yeah, the
John. What Gerald Ford did was to change the description of the wound of the back, which was the uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration because it was actually 5.5 inches down below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column. Only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger. And Sam Kinney, who was a driver of the Secret Service Cadillac, colloquially known as a Queen Mary, was given a bucket of sponge and a water to wash out the blood and brains, which is already the destruction of evidence at Parkland. He reported finding a slug that he took in and left on a stretcher at Parkland that would become the magic bullet. Now, For reasons I do not profess to understand, Paul Landis, another Secret Service agent, has claimed to have done that. But it appears to have been Sam Kinney. He confided in a neighbor, said not to release the information until after his death. He's gone. The neighbors reported it. It appears to be the story. Yet Paul Landis, and he's cited in your book, Jerry, of course, claims to be the one who found the bullet. But the point is, there was nothing magic about the bullet. That was all a fantasy. Go ahead, Jerry.
John, some of the things you're raising on the Tippett body and the like, again, we stayed away from things that are yet debatable.
Good.
Okay, we stayed with things that, you know, so we didn't want the book running down rabbit holes. They criticized that rabbit hole and they discredited the whole book. We just stayed very narrowly on to things.
Okay.
So, for instance, we don't attempt to identify who the shooters were. We don't say we can know precisely where they were. We know the shots came from the front. Now, there's still some debate about the front because there's things that, again, we could debate about, which
Jerry,
was the exact angle of Jack Kennedy's head when he was hit by the shot to the forehead. You know, that could mean the shot might have come from the across the south side of Dealey Plaza from the shooter up at the railroad yard. It might have come from a second shooter on the grassy knoll. You know, it might have come from the sewer. I mean, we don't get Jerry, into that.
Jerry, I think that
we know for sure it was a frontal shot.
Jerry, I think your conservative approach was just fine. But notice when you said there were at least three shooters, you meant based on the headshot evidence that there was one from the front who fired the forehead, one from the side, and then the one in the back of the head, just from the headshot. But notice we've already got the shot to the front. That's a fourth shooter. We've already got the shot to the back. That's a fifth shooter. So actually you have evidence there of a minimum of five shooters. And that's not to take into account other shooters. It was Lyndon's hitman was actually in the Daltex firing at John Connolly in the mistaken belief it was Ralph Yarborough. Now, that's a sixth shooter. We had Roscoe White on the grassy. I'm not attributing this to you, David. Jerry, I'm explaining what other research has established, which I've been deeply involved. Roscoe White was on the grassy knoll. He was using a handgun, but he would have hit Jackie. So he pulled his shot. It wound up in the grass. Well, those are six and seven shooters. The only one unaccounted for actually was on the grassy knoll behind a tree. You wouldn't think there could be one there, but I have seen photographs of two different photographs of him standing there with a rifle in the possession of two different experts on JFK. So there actually were eight different shooters, believe it or not. John, but I'm not attributing that to you and David, Jerry. I'm explaining this based on...
But what we say in the book is the testimony, for instance, of Kellerman, who was in the, you know, the sitting in the front seat but not driving. He was in the shotgun seat. So the... Kellerman said there was a flurry of bullets.
Yes.
And there were bullets that missed. There were bullets. I think David Bantick is right that the bullet that hit in the back was not a shot, but shrapnel from a bullet that missed and flew up from it. We don't know for sure all these
things.
There's going to be some things about the Kennedy assassination that are never going to be known for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the great principles of criminology. The great criminologists will tell you that in every murder, there's going to be some things you can't figure out for sure.
There was in addition, based on my conversations and exchange with Dennis David, with Gerald Custer, with Paul O'Connor, and I met and had drinks with these guys, Jerry, in Dallas. Of course. They were the techs, medical techs at Bethesda. Now, Dennis David explained there was an additional casket brought in. He was ordered not to log in. That was contrary to standard protocol. They referred to him as the major. You actually have photographs, autopsy photographs, with the eyes open. Chuck Crenshaw explained to me he closed JFK's eyes when he assisted before he put him into the bronze ceremonial casket. That's not JFK. That's the major. And David... Larry Rivera has done superpositions. We did one of JFK's profile over that body with the eyes open and the big gash, and it's not the body of JFK. That's a body double. That's a major. And if you got the whole military, you're going to be able to find somebody who looks a whole lot like anyone you want, except it was so bad that when they were contemplating an open casket, Jackie and Bobby said he doesn't even look like himself. And I think that's because what they were looking at was not JFK. John, I know you got things you want to add. Go for it.
I was muted. I followed this stuff for years myself, too. And I know Mr. Corsi wants to stick in a certain direction. But yeah, all those things add up. I mean, I was holding up the fingers. Yeah, there was at least eight shooters on the people I know about. And there was even one over by the postal building in a parking lot way off to the right of Dealey Plaza, which is opposite the grassy knoll area. They had standby shooters. I mean, I know a guy named Robert Tosh Plumlee, and I think he passed away in the last year and a half or so. He was one of the standby people for an escape thing because they were flying people in like Barry Seal and all these other people. But, you know, I ran into a guy, a very interesting guy in San Diego by the name of G. Gordon Liddy. And they said he was involved in something with Tibbet because they had to do a duplication, as you refer to the major, because they had to have another body that matched him, and they picked him out ahead of time, which is what CIA will do, and did headshots to make sure the front wasn't damaged. So that was the switch, allegedly, that I'm thinking about. So I actually ran into him. He was doing some sort of a filming, and I parked my car, got my business card out, and immediately identified myself so he didn't get reactive because he didn't know if he was going to get assassinated or not. And I gave him a card. It's just an interesting connection because I don't go out and looking. It happens to me. I ran into Jack Ford, who I used to protect. But there's a lot of interesting connections with this stuff. And I was going to ask specifically about any mercury tip bullet theory because they allege that the reason why they were cleaning up and switching things around is because they think maybe a mercury tip bullet from a shooter with a 223 or a Bushmaster might have used.
Well, again, these things are all possible. I think, you know, first of all, a point that I think is definitive here is that there's a lot of things that do not fit together in the government's cover-up story. The government's cover-up story was so concocted to change obvious frontal wounds at Parkland to back wounds. They had to go, this was, you know, the Kennedy assassination from the government's point of view was a screw up because it should have all been set, but Kennedy only had a shot from the back. Now, the problem is when you shoot at the president of the United States, the one thing you got to do is you got to kill him. So, you know, there's even photographs after they're past the Triple Underpass and headed to the hospital over on one of the, I guess it was a car dealer on the roof, appears to be a guy running with a rifle. So they had probably lots of shooters to make sure that he was going to be killed. Backup shooters. A guy named Sartee was a Corsican sniper, well-known assassin, was arrested and documented to be arrested at Daley Plaza the day of the shooting. He, again, was let go. So the problem the government had was that the story that Lee Harvey Oswald with the Mannlicher Caetano rifle fired three shots in under 6 seconds and shot Jack Kennedy and John Connolly with two bullets, despite these diverse wounds, and the bullet that survives is pristine. That story is so preposterous. The government's going through contortions to try to fit it together. And for all of us who have looked at it over the years, we know it's a ridiculous story. We know there has to be other explanations. But what we call this book The Final Analysis is because when Mantic did his work and he proved that the x-rays are forgeries, they're not the original, he proves that there were two frontal shots that can be clearly seen in the x-rays, that the Harper fragment fit in the back of the skull, that there was one autopsy picture, this F8, that seems to be authentic. It's taken from the back of Kennedy's head. You can see actually his nipples is taken through, and the whole back of the head is missing. That looks like the only authentic autopsy photograph that we have. And again, the Harper fragment can be located in that. The Harper fragment has evidence of beveling with copper, with metal on it for an entrance wound. So obviously, it was hit in the back of the head first and moved forward. Then the shot blew out the back of his head, and that's the back and to the left that we see in the Zapruder film. But the Zapruder film has been altered. Yet we can see the blowout in the back of the head. So in other words, once we know that there were two frontal shots, we know that the x-rays are forged, we know the government lied, we know the government's covering up its own complicity, we know this is a coup d'etat, we know the story that this is a random nut case lone gunman is a lie. That the fundamental today, the most important thing about the Kennedy assassination is rock solid proof. The government lies to us. It creates narratives to reframe reality, to have massive shifts in public opinion to move towards more government control. So after Jack Kennedy assassination, well, we really want the president to be safe now. After 9/11, we better pass the Patriot Act, give the government all kinds of new powers. You know, why are buildings falling down that weren't hit by the airplanes? You know, on these questions don't get in. Why does it look like a controlled fall when a building would not only have collapsed into itself, but not collapsed altogether? That's the normal architecture of a building collapsing. So the government's stories, because they are lies, are full of holes. And all the speculation we're doing here, what the truth is still arguable.
Now, well,
granted, some of it's more concrete than others. But the point, the major point that the American public has to see is the paradigm shift of the predominant narrative, which is Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, a bad day for Jack Kennedy because a nutcase got a rifle, to the fact that this was a carefully planned government operation that was designed to frame Lee Harvey Oswald, to cover up the evidence, and to create a story in which the government's complicity was completely hidden in order to remove Jack Kennedy, mainly for many reasons. But Jack Kennedy, I think, when he didn't want to go to war in a Cuban Missile Crisis, we back-channeled to Khrushchev. When he gave a speech at American University, he said, in the final analysis, we all live in a small planet. We've got to coexist. He passed a national security order for pulling out of Vietnam. Well, Curtis LeMay had enough. Military had enough. They were going to plan Vietnam. They wanted to go to war, where billions of dollars going to be made. And Jack Kennedy, this peacenik president, wasn't going to stand in their way. Now, there were other reasons. But I want to comment, time we've got, on my research on, and I think you guys will agree with me, on John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles.
Well, before you go there, I think it's correct to say the final analysis of the medical evidence. That's what you got there. But as you yourself have conceded, it doesn't deal with the politics.
Jim, what we can do now that we know that this was a coup d'etat, all these other questions now are relevant to debate.
Well, they always were. We can walk and chew gum at the same time, Jerry. We've all been doing that right along. I mean, you know, I've been.
You can, John can, I can. To the average American out there who hasn't paid as much attention to this,
well,
if they do realize that the government's lied all this time, and that's clear to them now that they were lied to, suddenly they're going to pay attention to all these other arguments.
Well, Jerry, look, I admire the book and what you and David have done. If one wants to go further, Larry Rivera's book, The JFK Horseman, is indispensable to understand the limo stop, because these headshots, all three occurred while the limousine was stationary in Dealey Plaza. Greer pulled the limo to the left and to a halt. They even had painted yellow stripes on the curb to show the area where the limousine should be brought to a halt. So Larry Rivera has done brilliant work, The JFK Horseman. And if you want the larger political context, my fourth book on JFK, Who, How, and Why, goes into the politics and the arrangement in general, where my work is refined by this, and largely was built on work of David and Doug Horn and David Lifton and so forth in the past anyway. John, I know you want to squeeze. Let me just add one word. The alleged resemblance between Tippit and JFK has been exaggerated. Now, Robert Morningstar is a friend of mine. I like him a lot. But I have the Earl Rose autopsy report on Tippit lying there on the gurney, lying there on the table. He doesn't look remotely like JFK. No one would ever mistake him. So while he was shot three times in the body, and then when he was lying there, he was shot in the forehead, and it was, I think, to resemble the wounds of JFK. He doesn't pass for JFK. So he was not the body double. It was the major. And Larry and I have done the superposition to show that body. It's in your book, of course. You have these photographs with the gaping and the open eyes. That's not actually JFK. That's the major. John, you go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just following along with what you guys are saying. I mean, I agree with you. And it took me a while to figure out, while I was in Secret Service, just to support what you guys both saying, yeah, we're being lied to. And I went to other government agencies in the Treasury, and we're still being lied to. The government's still doing it. And I made a little quote there because Eisenhower used to say it, beware the military-industrial complex. He knew that stuff even back in the 50s. Nixon was his vice president. And then later, I think there was an earlier thing about Kennedy and Eisenhower and stuff like that. So they knew what they were doing. It's just to the extreme that if people really realize all the details, and we're only talking about surface subjects that are very clear. And Jerome has a perfect point on these things with the evidence, the x-rays, the doctors saying what they said. I did ask about the mercury tip bullet then, because apparently they may have tried to clean out and get rid of the mercury, which would be impossible. No, but that's if it was mercury.
But Jerry talked about that. He said the bullet that ended in the front was mercury, and they couldn't get it out of the x-ray. So he covered that.
I agree with that. I think that was likely mercury, and I don't think they could get it wrong. They were stuck with that.
It was mercury.
And that was, again, trying to alter the evidence, mistakes were made. Okay, so the plot is they only put three shells there. Well, they knew that, and Jim is right. You can see that they had painted this yellow area, which was the kill zone on the curb. You can see it in the pictures. This little one part of the sidewalk on the south side of Dealey Plaza is painted yellow. And why would that be? Okay, so they're marking out the kill zone right there. And they put three shots up here because they know in that kill zone, with the rifle they're going to plant, they've only got a window and a bold action for three shots. And the guy'd have to be pretty good to have two of them hit. Do it in that bold action, acquiring the target in six seconds with three shots. But the problem was that we're stuck with things because they couldn't get rid of that trace across the upper right hand. You could see that bullet was clearly an entrance wound, and anybody looking at that x-ray could see it. Now, and so they had to make decisions to alter evidence that were carelessly made hastily, and were done sloppily, and actually don't make sense. Now, for the purpose of what I want to accomplish today, I want to get the average person out there to understand, no, we can't solve every case. We can't answer all these questions. There are a lot of good books out there. You know, Jim has written good books. There's good books. Larry Rivera has done excellent work. There's many people who have done excellent work. And we may never settle some of these debates. But what we will settle is that this was a coup d'etat that the government spent a lot of time planning. It was intricately planned. It was designed and executed so the JFK would not be protected and vulnerable in a car. They had a kill window and evidence was altered. And so we know from a fact, and this will shock the American people who today are trying to figure out what's going on in Ukraine. Why do we go to Afghanistan? You know, what is this? Why were we in Iraq in 2000 with George W. Bush and we left Saddam Hussein sitting there? Why did 9/11 fall? This question after question after question, where we can understand that the government has manipulated us intentionally using psychological warfare, creating these massive issues. Okay, the cargo ship hits the bridge, and the bridge is now. Wait a minute. So already, people are conditioned to say that's not by accident. That doesn't just happen. You know, that's if they were headed to get under that bridge, even if they had a power failure, they would have just sailed right under that bridge. Why were they aiming to hit the stanchion that supported the entire bridge? Okay, so there's things that don't fit together when the government is lying. And yet people have a hard time saying, you mean the government of the United States, you mean at the highest levels, planned to kill Kennedy? Yes, that's what this means. They did, and they lied about it. And they spent an enormous amount of money. And they had to have the cooperation of the media. They had to have the cooperation of the Justice Department. J. Edgar Hoover had to go along with this. CIA had to go along with it. Military was there at the autopsy. They orchestrated the autopsy. The United States government, in a massive way, decided to kill Kennedy and make sure the American people never knew they did it. to blame it on this poor guy who was a Marine, had probably been part of an intelligence operation defecting to the Soviet Union, probably was always working for the government, probably got paid very little, was also reporting to the FBI, probably getting paid very little, and his life was a mess, and they blame this guy, and then they kill him in order to protect the public from knowing or suspect, and then they lie about it. And the book has at the back of it a memo from the CIA from 67 that says, anybody who dares object to the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission's report is a national security threat because they're trying to blame the government, so therefore we're going to run psychological operations and we're going to destroy every critic. That memo is back there. It was released. That was official CIA policy. Okay, now, all of this fits together in a way that's going to shock the American people as a paradigm shift. You know, if you find out that something happened between your father and your mother you never knew about when you were a kid that wasn't good, one of them had an affair, or one of them wasn't who you thought they were, or what, any particular thing that you find out as an adult that you didn't know as a child, your whole image of your childhood changes. Your innocence is gone. And once the innocence is gone, the American people, they will open their eyes. You cannot create a government this powerful with a unelected bureaucracy. You know, why? I caught HSBC money laundering 2011. And I had the evidence of it. I printed it at WorldNet Daily. Got called by the Senate Permanent Investigating Committee. Got called by the Department of Homeland Security. Went to a building downtown in Manhattan with no windows. Spent the day with them. And the Senate Investigating Committee, Permanent Investigating Committee, wrote like a 500-page report. HSBC laundering money for the drug cartels. The CIA and the Treasury Department were in on that because you can't do wire transfers of money that aren't monitored by our government.
Jerry, we're about to hit. Look, you've been wonderful. Just underscore a key point you made during dinner with James Files. He mentioned to me two times, once a government takes a stand, it's stuck with it and will never change. And that's what James, no matter how much the evidence. Thank you to Jerry Corsi. Thank you to Carl. And
recording stuff.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Industrial Complex podcast here on Revolution Radio, Studio B, every Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Get fit, empowered, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
My name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion.